Welcome to Pardes Daily, where you get your daily dose of Torah with Pardes faculty. For the next 2 weeks, Pardes is bringing Purim to you. Let's dive in.
This is Nechama Goldman-Barish coming to you from Jerusalem. In today's podcast, we are going to further define the difference between a large city and a village. As was discussed previously when we learned the first two Mishnayot in the chapter, a village has the flexibility of hearing the Megillah on the closest market day to the 14th. Market days, or days of assembly when the rabbinic courts were in session, were on Mondays and Thursdays. If the 14th of Adar fell on one of those days, both villages and large cities celebrated together. Walled cities dating back to Joshua's time celebrated on the 15th of Adar. However, if the 14th was on any other day of the week, villagers would celebrate on the nearest Monday or Thursday so as not to inconvenience them by requiring them to come back to the large city where there would be literate people who would know how to read the Megillah scroll. Since Adar as a month was marked for celebration and Purim is a rabbinic holiday, there was more flexibility with regard to its commemoration. We are now going to read the next two Mishnayot in Chapter 1, Mishnas 3 and 4. Ezohi ir gedola, kol sheyesh ba asara batlanim. What is considered a large city? Any city in which there are 10 men who are idle. I'm going to come back to the batlanim after I finish reading this Mishnah, because they appear in other parts of different parts of the Mishnah, and they are an interesting sociological phenomena that are referred to elsewhere. Pachon mikan hareze kvar. If there are less than 10 idlers, then that's really a village. Be'elo amru makdimim velo ma'acharin. So it was with regard to these times, the sages said you advance the reading of the Megillah before the 14th, and you don't postpone it till after the 14th. And that is unusual. That is unique to Purim, because normally we push off a date if there's a potential problem. We'll see in a moment some of those examples. We never advance the date to an earlier time, except with regard to Purim and the Megillah reading. Aval zman atzei kohanim v'tisha ba'av, chagiga v'hakel, ma'acharin v'lo makdimin. So now here are the examples where we postpone and we never advance. And what are those examples? When the families of priests would donate wood for the fire on the altar, because it would be in rotation, so no one family would bear too much of the burden for the wood that had to be donated to the temple to burn on the altar. If their day of donating was a Shabbat, they would push it off until the next day, because you could not donate wood on Shabbat. V'tisha b'av, if the 9th of Av fell on a Shabbat, you don't fast that fast on Shabbat, you push it off till Sunday. We read that already, that the same thing, the festival peace offering that was brought on the festivals was not brought on Shabbat. And the commandment of Hakel, that the entire Jewish people were supposed to meet in the temple courtyard every 7 years on Sukkot to hear the king read the book of Deuteronomy, that is postponed until after Shabbat, and you don't advance it to before Shabbat. Afal pi shamru makdimim v'lo ma'achrin, mutarim be'aspeid uvetaniyot umatanot levyonim. So we find out, even though the sages said you advance the time for reading the Megillah and one does not postpone, one is permitted to eulogize and fast on these days because they're not actually Purim. On real Purim, on the 14th, or on the 15th, depending on when you're not allowed to eulogize or fast. So this early Purim, where you read the Megillah on the 11th, 12th, 13th, depending when market day comes vis-a-vis the 14th, then we treat it like Purim and not like Purim. So you're permitted to eulogize and fast, which you're not allowed to do on real Purim. But you can also give gifts to the poor. That's not a problem. So you get to keep some of the laws, but not all of the laws traditionally associated with Purim. Amar Rabbi Yehuda, imatai makom shenichnasim b'sheni uvachamishi, ova makom shein nichnasim lo b'sheni v'lo b'chamishi, ein korin ota ela bizmana. And Rabbi Yehuda now says, okay, when do we do that? When do we read the Megillah a day or two early in a place where there's market day, where there are days of assembly on Monday and Thursday. But if it's a place where there's no market day, where there are no days of assembly and they don't come into town on Monday and Thursday, then you have to read the Megillah on its designated time. In other words, just because it's a village doesn't give it this pass. It has to be a village that comes into the larger towns on Monday and Thursday for it to work. Okay, and so that is the third mishnah in the chapter. I want to pause for a minute to reflect on the idea of idlers or men who are unemployed and idle around the city. It's an interesting one and comes up in other parts of the Talmud. Namely, there's a question, it appears in Psachim as well as in the Tractate of Ta'anit, about the custom to refrain from working on certain days like Tisha B'Av. The Mishnah determines that in a place where the custom is to work, one may work. And if the custom is not to work on Tisha B'Av, one may not work. It's all determined by custom. This is an important declaration reinforcing the inclusion of the social religious behavior of a community as determining practice and not only law. Anyway, Rabbi Yehuda states that Torah scholars should not work in any case on Tisha B'Av. This leads to a question whether it will look like yuhara or arrogance if someone refrains from working in a town where everyone works. Arrogance is considered problematic, even if done in the name of religious piety. The answer given is that it will never look like arrogance for someone to refrain from working. Go out to the marketplace and see how many batlanim, how many unemployed people are idling around. In other words, in every community, there will always be those who are unemployed. So refraining for work will not particularly stand out. The Mishnah also brings us the other times when rituals are delayed but never advanced. Reading the Megillah in advance of the 14th is unique to Purim alone. Otherwise, when a holiday clashes with Shabbat in any way, we push off the holiday. The date actually has to have arrived in order to celebrate or commemorate it. Purim, as we've said a few times, is unique because Kshenichnas Adar Marbim B'Simcha, the whole month is really open for celebration, joyousness, and commemoration of the miracle of salvation. I'll read the next Mishnah, the fourth Mishnah in the chapter. Karuta Megillah Ba'Adar HaRishon V'Nitabra HaShana Korinota Ba'Adar HaSheni Ein Ben Adar HaRishon La'Adar HaSheni Ela Kriyat HaMegillah U'Matanot Levyonim. So if the people read the Megillah during the first Adar, and subsequently they had to add another month of Adar so that Passover would be in the spring, Ibur HaChodesh, intercalating the year. And what happens? You now have a second Adar. So you actually have to read the Megillah again during the second Adar. The second Adar is the month in which Purim is going to be celebrated. The first Adar is secondary to the second Adar. Even though you've already celebrated Purim in the first Adar, if there's an Ibur Chodesh, you've intercalated the year, and you've added an extra month, you have to celebrate Purim again. And the principle is as follows. Ein ben Adar Rishon Adar Sheni. There's no difference between the first Adar and the second Adar, except the reading of the Megillah and distributing gifts to the poor, which is a way of saying that Purim's in the second month, not in the first month, meaning that's an enormous difference. But it becomes a methodology. Ein ben. There's no difference between A and B except C, but C is an enormous difference. And in the rest of the chapter, there are going to be multiple examples given, nothing to do with Purim, a lot to do with different holidays and Shabbat, and we're going to see the temple and different eras of the temple and different clothing of the high priest and so on and the regular priest, and they're all going to start with Ein Bein. There is no difference between A and B except C. Until the end of this podcast, I would like to share with you a short piece of Gemara that speaks about gifts to the poor and particularly Mishloach Manot. Now, what we've had in these two Mishnahs are two references to Matanot Le'Evyonim. If you read the Megillah a few days early, you can still give Matanot, gifts to the poor, Matanot Le'Evyonim, a few days early. And we just discovered there's no difference between Adar Aleph and Adar Bet, the first Adar and the second Adar, except reading the Megillah and giving gifts to the poor, which you must do in the second Adar. What's missing is the Su'udat Purim, the Purim feast, which we know is one of the mitzvot, and Mishloach Manot Ish L'Reyehu, which Mordechai instructs Esther to write down as one of the main pieces of the holiday that's going to become Purim. The Mishnah does not refer to either of those mitzvot, and it's the Gemara that's going to bring us more information, not very much, but a little more information about the Mishloach Manot. And what I'd like to look at is the challenge that Mishloach Manot puts before us. In other words, gifts to the poor we're not very challenged by. In fact, the Braita that is brought in the Gemara says, Rav Yosef teaches us that you send Mishloach Manot ish l'reyehu. He quotes the text from Megillat Esther, sending portions one to the other. You have to give two portions to one person, and gifts to the poor means two gifts to two people. So you have to give two poor people one gift each. Okay, we know how to do that. The Gemara now brings three stories that speaks to the tension that is inherent in gift-giving. In the first, which appears in the manuscript editions of the Babylonian Talmud and the Yerushalmi, Rabbi Judah the prince sends the leg of a calf born third to its mother and a jug of wine to his colleague, Rabbi Yoshaya the elder. To put it clearly, a huge steak and a big bottle of wine. But Rabbi Yoshaya is not pleased. His response is, thanks for the matanot levionim, or charity that you sent me. Rabbi Judah picks up on the insulted tone and sends back an entire calf and barrel of wine. Now Rabbi Yoshaya responds, thank you for the matanot levionim. In the second story, Rava, who is now head of the yeshiva or academy, sends his colleague Mari a basket of dates and a cup of roasted flour. In other words, a very simple and expensive mishloach manot. His nephew Abaye, tasked with delivering this, comments that Mari is surely going to comment that when the farmer becomes king, shouldn't he take the feed bucket off from around his neck? In other words, the head of the academy should not behave like a poor yeshiva student. Mari in turn sends back a far more extravagant but pointed gift, ginger and peppercorns. Abaye notes that Rava may take offense at sending something sweet and receiving something pungent and sharp. Both of these stories illustrate the complex emotions and expectations that are triggered by gift-giving. A mitzvah of gift-giving directed at our friends brings up questions of what kind of gift is good enough? How much do I have to spend? What if I'm not good at gift-giving? Or is that all my friends and colleagues think of me? In the first story, Rabbi Yoshaya felt that Rabbi Judah the prince, an extremely wealthy man, could do better than his initial gift. In the second, Abaye was shocked that Rava had not put more thought into his portions now that he was elevated to a position of leadership. There was a great article in Tablet magazine last year called The Mishloach Manot Wars, in which it described some of the creative and extravagantly thematic ways in which people enthusiastically approach the holiday and specifically Mishloach Manot. There is no question that receiving such portions is fun and exciting, fitting into the liveliness of the Purim holiday. But at what point does it become too much financially and emotionally on those who do not have the creativity or the ability to pull it off? Some shuls have moved to communal mishloach manot to alleviate the stress and financial outlay. The last story in the Gemara about mishloach manot is about two brothers who simply exchanged their Purim meals to fulfill the mitzvah of mishloach manot. It is a wonderful illustration of preserving both the letter and spirit of the law by gladdening the other with food cooked to be eaten as part of the celebration of the day and without causing greater financial outlay than each would spend for their own meal. In short, this mitzvah warrants thoughtfulness and thinking about its meaning and how it can serve both sender and recipient, contributing to the overall happiness of the holiday.
Thank you to our Pardes faculty. And a big thanks to you, our learners. Make sure to check back in every day to stay on track with your learning. And visit www.pardes.org.il for more information about other ways to learn with Pardes.